You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
It's amazing. Here's
what happened.
Lashari Robinson, a custodian for LA Unified, is picking up bagged lunches from Dimerly High School in South LA for herself and her two kids.
We just normally get Pop-Tarts, milk, juice.
That's King, Robinson's five-year-old son. He walks with her every day to collect the food. He's an active kid. But since the pandemic, he doesn't get to be outdoors like he used to.
I like to play sport. AGL is my coach. And I wanted to do a routine with him on Zoom. And then we're practicing how to do basketball.
So this daily walk, a few blocks there and back to get food, has become his outing, his exercise, and his time to commune with urban nature.
I see bees and butterflies and ladybugs.
Stay-at-home orders meant many folks lost access to nature, especially if you live in a community where homes have no yard or where neighborhoods lack open green space or parks or trails. If you're feeling cooped up as an adult, imagine doing it as a kid. Playgrounds are still roped off, and some have been inside for months. Yet as parks and beaches are now more and more open, reporter Deepa Fernandez tells us not all kids are able to get out there and get back into nature, and they are feeling that loss.
As five-year-old King and his mum walk the few blocks home from picking up food, Lashari Robinson makes sure they take in nature. Today, they spy a tree with papayas ripening.
I haven't had a papaya before. It's in California. It's in Abu Dhabi. It's in South America.
King points out the bees, the butterflies, even the ants.
I made an ant house for the ants. All you do is need to put a slide in a can, and then you tape it up together, and then have a welcome sign saying, "Welcome ants."
His mum is doing everything she can to make sure her active five-year-old isn't stuck inside.
I feel lucky we have a yard. Very, very lucky.
The yard, it's great, but it's tiny. Not enough space to just run free. In the past, they used to go to the park.
But he hasn't really been able to play since the pandemic, so it's hard.
The time indoors isn't just an inconvenience.
When children learn, explore, play in nature, they tend to be happier, healthier, and smarter.
Sarah Milligan-Toffler is the executive director of Children and Nature, a national nonprofit.
Just about 10 minutes per day, even looking at what's outside your window. What are the birds flying by? What trees can I see? Kind of connecting with the larger world and that sense of wonder does wonders for our levels of stress and anxiety.
But even in the best of times, lower-income city kids had less access to open space.
We know that communities have also been intentionally disconnected from parks, green space, from farming, gardening.
It's exactly why in South LA, a local food justice organization, Community Services Unlimited, started building small farms in the middle of the city. This mini urban farm is moments away from downtown skyscrapers and on the edge of a community that's home to many low-income families of color.
So here we've got carrots growing.
Co-executive director Heather Fenny is on her knees pulling out weeds. She's pointing to a patch of springy green carrot tops.
We planted these just before the stay-at-home orders went in place, and we're starting to harvest them now.
In this green oasis in the middle of the city, a plethora of fruits and veggies are sprouting from the ground. But it's quiet, just Fenny and one other staff member. Normally, she tells me, it's buzzing with activity.
Young kids are frequent visitors to the farm where they can come and taste the leaves right off the plants, pick the berries right off the bushes, follow butterflies, dig for worms.
Community Services Unlimited has cancelled all its summer programs for youth because gathering in groups is still too dangerous. It's a big loss for kids in the area. And it's not the only nature-based summer program being cut. Gerardo Salazar runs outdoor and environmental education for the LA Unified School District.
Due to COVID-19, we are regrettably going to have to cut summer programming, in particular to homeless youth and foster youth.
the Los Angeles School District has robust programs that bring kids to nature.
One of the highlights of that program is an overnight sail on a tall ship to Catalina Island.
Salazar is afraid that on top of losing summer programs, budget cuts might really hamper school year activities too.
Even though students live in Los Angeles, many of our students haven't been to the beach. And even though they can go outside and view the mountains from their neighborhoods, they've never been to the mountains.
Being in nature is not just nice, Salazar says. It's critical for a child's well-being. And it's full of learning opportunities.
When it comes to our night sky study, we look up at the stars. And many comment that, hey, we don't have those stars in our neighborhood. And to the astonishment of many adults, they explain to the children, yes, it's the same constellation, the same stars that you're looking at now is in your neighborhood, but due to light pollution, you don't get to see it.
As Salazar braces for the cuts that may be coming to his small slice of the education pie, the ripple has already hit some programs.
My name is Celeste Royer. I am the Director of Environmental Education at the Rancho El Choro Outdoor School.
Rancho El Choro started 49 years ago in San Luis Obispo. It has day programs, week-long trips, and full-time outdoor nature summer camps that serve kids in Central California. But the pandemic stopped all that.
Well, we were notified that due to financial challenges as a result of the pandemic, that the program would be closed and the staff was laid off.
Kids of farm workers and many low-income Latino children from surrounding counties attended Rancho El Choro's nature programs. Roya says for many of these children, it was the first time they'd ever sat by a campfire or taken a nature hike.
In addition to just getting outside, it's the being with your friends and the teamwork you develop.
Rancho El Choro's sudden demise in the midst of the pandemic is not unusual, according to new survey data released by researchers at UC Berkeley. Craig Strang, Associate Director of the university's Lawrence Hall of Science, analyzed answers from a survey that 1,000 nature and outdoor education organizations filled out in April.
About 30% of all the programs in the country would be definitely unable to reopen or very unlikely to reopen if they had to stay closed until December 31st, and that only about 22% of all the programs would definitely be able to reopen.
Many programs bring in most of their annual budget in the spring and summer months.
With their program shut down during the pandemic, they've lost revenue and have very little reserves or infrastructure to be able to survive even 1 month, much less several months in a row without revenue.
Yet, of the programs confident they will reopen, Strang says they too will have to make cuts. Likely to go are scholarships, subsidized transportation, and other financial help to families who can't afford full price.
It is a devastating outcome.
Nature may become a luxury item. Yet Sarah Milligan-Toffler of Children and Nature believes there could be a solution here if school districts could think about reopening in the fall utilizing a simple concept, outdoor classrooms.
Right now, there's a particular case for greening school ground because you can social distance on a school ground and you're much less likely to pass or contract the virus in an outdoor setting.
While some school campuses may have lots of tree cover, an outdoor space rich in biodiversity, where a class and a teacher can nestle themselves, many schools are blacktop and lack any trees. But still doable, Toffler says.
You can set up outdoor learning stations with handmade shelters that could be simple things put up with a tarp to protect kids and teachers from the sun.
This would help get kids back to school more safely. And it would place them directly outside.
More and more, we're seeing that the relationship with the natural world actually matters in terms of our ability to retain information.
Plus, she says, all the tens of thousands of laid-off nature educators nationwide, they have expertise in how kids learn in the outdoors. Put them to work, Toffler says, to help classroom teachers make the shift to outdoor learning. Win-win. For KCRW, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Yeah, in case you haven't noticed, it's June. And for K through 12, you know what that means. If that Alice Cooper classic reminds you of students busting down the doors to leave the local high school, I would be quick to remind you that those buildings have been closed. And over the past couple of months, we here at Greater LA have been talking to a couple of LAUSD teachers about doing school from home. So maybe it's time for a report card. Christy Collette is a third grade teacher at Newcastle Elementary in Reseda. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Steve.
And Hazel Kite with them, teaches English at Venice High School on the West Side. Hi, Hazel.
Hi.
I want to start with you, Hazel, because you've been finishing up students' final work of the year. How'd they do?
Goodness. Well, I started to hear from more students toward the end, and I tried to offer a variety of options for them to close out their year with significance. There were still several students in every class that I didn't hear from at all during this school closure. And so in asking how they did, I really keep reflecting on how did I do? I've been beating myself up a bit about my inability to reach out individually to each student. So I feel like there's so much that I wish I could have done differently. And when I hear from students, they are beating themselves up so much about what they didn't do or how they got distracted or lost motivation. And it's just been really hard to hear. So here at the end, I'm just sort of hoping that students are taking care of themselves and not beating themselves up too much for this really challenging time.
I want to get you into the conversation, Christy, because, you know, the school year ended. You teach younger children. What sort of a letter grade would you give to yourself for last year, to yourself as a teacher from home?
Okay, for myself, I'm going to give myself a B.
Okay.
I'll be kind to myself.
All right, that's good. B is good, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, considering the circumstances in which we were forced to change our the way that we've been working our entire lives, I think I did okay.
Okay.
Is there room for improvement? Always.
We've talked to you over the course of time, Christy, about the fact that, you know, some students weren't there. It was a really low percentage, right, of some, early on at least, of the students who were being receptive to what you were doing.
I have found that even within my school, and of course it varies so much from school to school, that my class, I think, had one of the lowest percentages of participation.
Oh, so when did that start improving, or did it improve?
It did improve. I was actually assigned a TA, and her main job was literally to call the kids the morning before the Zoom meeting and make sure that they got on.
Yeah.
So that did help a great deal. And I had spoke with a few people about this, that one of our biggest problems was letting, you know, when the parents and the kids knew that their grades were not going to be affected because they didn't turn in work.
Some pediatricians, I know there have been, you know, countless stories about doctors who say, you know, the kids need to get back in the classroom. Even the risks of coronavirus aren't outweighed by the fact that those kids need to be in a learning environment. Do you guys agree? Hazel, I'll ask you that first.
100%. When the Pediatricians Association came out with that information, I was hugely relieved. I don't know what it looks like yet, but it was an affirmation that this does not work in this way. And we need each other. We need to be present with each other. We need the routine and the schedule. But I also think that this time has shown us so many of the cracks in our system, and that grades should not be the motivator for why students are showing up and engaging in the work. So if when we take away the concern about grades, if students just then stop engaging in their education, then we're doing something wrong. We're not making our curriculum relevant to what these students need on a daily basis. And we're seeing now this incredible moment of uprising and people fighting for equality and students taking the lead in some of that. We need to understand that we have to change how we do business in school. We have to make school a place of liberation. Like, we have such an opportunity now to reimagine what we offer to students, what we ask them to bring to the table. You know, how do they want to be engaged? So I think this is a moment of real learning. And though school may be out for the summer for students, teachers really need to go to work and start learning about how, as educators, we can address our own racial biases. We can, like, really unearth the embedded racism in our system that is causing so many students to feel like it doesn't matter to them.
Christy, do you agree with that? I mean, obviously, those are great things to think about, right? And we all want to be more introspective about the things that we do and how we look at other people. And, you know, but as far as getting back in the classroom physically, are you concerned about your health in that case?
I do have underlying autoimmune issues, so that part of it does concern me. And I've seen some of the, you know, possible ideas for next year, which, you know, should be interesting. But I never until this point realized how much of our job is the relationships that we have with them. That's 99% of our job. And if we're not seeing them and we're not communicating with them, we can't do our job. So that part has been very difficult.
I know there are plans to open LAUSD by August. Each individual school, though, is going to need to make those adjustments, right? You're in Venice, right, Hazel?
Yes.
What is your school doing to make those accommodations? And will all the students be in the classroom or just some of them? Do we have any, has it been hashed out how that's going to work?
No, that hasn't been hashed out yet. I think that we are trying out lots of different options or ideas. I'm not in the room for those conversations. I really want to be, but yeah, LAUSD just sent out a survey to parents and teachers to ask about what we all think needs to be in place. So that is still very much a work in progress.
What about you, Christy, at Newcastle? What are they doing there at school to make sure that when the students come back, it's a safe environment?
Also, I have absolutely no idea. My school is very small. We only have about 320 students. So for us, it, I imagine, is going to be significantly easier than somewhere like a high school setting where there are so many more students. But as far as the details, we have not heard anything.
Hazel Kite-Witham, who teaches English over at Venice High School, Christy Collette, third grade teacher at Newcastle and Reseda. Thanks to you both, and good luck to you guys.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
I give you an A for effort. We're all trying.
That was mostly my approach to final grades. There you go.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. In Santa Monica, the city council last night took several steps that it says will improve race relations and reform its police department. Protests near the pier late last month brought hundreds of people to decry the death of George Floyd and many other black people at the hands of police. But a handful of folks took advantage of those peaceful protests, defacing and robbing more than 150 stores in the downtown area of Santa Monica. And now more than 60,000 people have signed a petition to oust the current police chief, Cynthia Renaud, for failing to protect those businesses. Santa Monica has had a complicated past with race relations, and Frances Anderton, a longtime resident of the city, joins us now from KCRW's Design and Architecture Desk to talk about it. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
You listened in to that city council meeting, which, by the way, was a marathon session. What is the mood like in Santa Monica at the moment?
Well, I would say that it's very mixed. And I should say that I myself moved here in 91, which was just before the civil unrest of 92. And I remember very well K-Town and South LA going up in flames and how much Santa Monica remained chill and untouched by all that. This time around, it was very different. Protest organizers made a deliberate decision to come to affluent neighborhoods like Santa Monica and Beverly Hills. And frankly, a lot of people in Santa Monica were very keen to participate in those protests. They shared the outrage. However, as you referred to, there was a lot of damage done in downtown Santa Monica, a lot of theft, and people are very angry at the police department for the perceived failure to protect those businesses, while paying a lot of attention, by the way, to the peaceful protesters. And these are businesses that were already very badly impacted by COVID and the shutdown.
You know, Francis, the city of L.A. was planning to cut budgets but give police a raise. That's been walked back a little bit. The mayor now, we had Eric Garcetti on the show yesterday saying that, you know, perhaps they'll cut the police budget by as much as $150 million. Is there any indication that Santa Monica is feeling the same heat? You see the hashtag now, defund police. Is that making its way to coastal LA County as well?
Yes, it is absolutely feeling that heat. Now, recall that Santa Monica has seen this huge drop in tax revenues due to COVID. The meeting last night was partly to address the slashing of its budget by almost 25%. And those cuts were to have affected almost every department except fire and police, who were to have seen a slight increase in their budget. Now, at the meeting last night, many people argued for defunding the police, which, by the way, really means reform or redirect funds towards, say, other social services, the kind of services that were being cut in the budget cuts. Now, out of that came an agreement last night by the City Council to review the Santa Monica Police Department's use of force policies and to reform that department based on that review. Of course, they will have to contend with Santa Monica's police union, which, like other police unions across the country, is very powerful.
Yeah, they certainly are very powerful. Francis, how have race relations played out in Santa Monica, past and present?
Well, they've been complicated. Santa Monica is generally a very liberal city. It's even called the People's Republic. At the same time, it has had its own tangled racial history. For example, let's take you back to the early years of the 20th century when beaches were essentially segregated. Nathaniel Travis is African-American and he remembers.
There was a beach called the Inkwell that was also where blacks finally got a chance to have a place on the beach, just a little bit south of the Del Mar Club. We used to have barbecues and stuff down there. And there was no sign saying it's a black beach. It was a cultural thing. That's where the blacks went. Don't go somewhere else. Go there, see?
Now, Nathaniel Travis actually wound up becoming the mayor of Santa Monica. The neighborhood that he referred to where that beach was, then called Belmar, now called Pico neighborhood, had a large black community. But then the 10 freeway was rammed through that community. Hundreds of families were displaced, contributing to a massive drop in the black population. It had been around 20%. It went down to now around 4%. On the other side, there have been big investments in that Pico neighborhood in recent years, in parks, in a new library. There's a big community history project underway. Despite these efforts, council members last night at the meeting unanimously agreed that the city needs what it's calling a Black agenda to help Black Santa Monicans address what it refers to as systemic racism in the city. Now, I also spoke with Dr. Antonio Shelton. He is the African-American principal of Santa Monica High School. And I asked him how he feels about Santa Monica today.
Have I felt that the community is a racist community? No, I definitely cannot say that. I feel like we're an open community. I think we're always open to suggestions and growth. But I do feel like there are opportunities specifically here for us to grow and understand and build relationships that are not just surface level, but deeper, so that everybody understands the individual struggle that exists for those of color in any given community.
Something, obviously, Francis, that people in Santa Monica are very concerned about as well, just like pretty much everywhere across LA, greater LA, and all across the country. KCRW's Francis Anderton from our design and architecture desk. Francis, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve.